From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. GPS, iPhones, Facebook, Foursquare, Google Chrome. These days, if you're on, they all know where you are, where you've been, who you're with often, what you're up to, lots of your life tracked. A case before the Supreme Court today, United States versus Jones, will set a path for how government, law enforcement, may use that path in the years ahead. And right now, this hour on Point, the Supreme Court on privacy, when technology can track your every move. You can join the conversation. Should police have free rein to track your car by GPS? Is that unreasonable search? And without a warrant, if this goes through, what next? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from Washington to look at the immediate case in question is Maggie Fox, managing technology editor at National Journal. Maggie, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Tell us about this case and Antoine Jones.
This is a really interesting case. Antoine Jones was a nightclub owner in Washington who was suspected of drug dealing, and The police had been trying to get him. They'd even bugged his cell phone. And they finally got a warrant to put a GPS device on his SUV so they could track him.
Yep.
Now, the problem comes in that they waited until the warrant already ran out before they started tracking him. And they tracked him, and they tracked him to a stash house where they caught him with about 200 kilos, about 200 pounds, 100 kilos of cocaine,
wow,
and a whole bunch of money. And he was convicted of conspiracy to deal drugs.
And a life sentence in prison, but that was overturned. By whom and why?
That was overturned by the appeals court, who said, hey, this violates the Fourth Amendment, which guarantees us the right against unreasonable search and seizure. Now, the judge in this case overturned on just one basis. It was the fact that the warrant had run out, and also the police had the warrant only for the District of Columbia, and they tracked Antoine Jones to nearby Maryland, where the stash house was. But it's been appealed to the Supreme Court, and the defense attorney actually wants to take up two issues, and the Supreme Court has agreed to hear arguments on two issues.
Okay.
One is that you can't have this warrantless use of the GPS device, that you have to have a warrant. But the second issue is whether you can even stick a GPS device on somebody's car at all, with or without a warrant. And the argument is that this is an unreasonable seizure of private property. It's a very interesting case.
So with warrant or even without warrant, can you do it? And even with a warrant, what did the appeals court say on that front, this kind of long-term or prolonged electronic monitoring?
Well, the appeals court didn't say a whole lot on this, but the argument against it is that this goes way above and beyond what's reasonable. Now, the prosecutors in the case argue, and the government is arguing, that, hey, this is just an extension of what police do every day. I mean, we could have followed this guy around and gotten this information. When you're out in your car on the public streets, you're in public, and you have no reasonable expectation of privacy. The defense argument against this is, hang on, there is no way in the world that any police force in the world could do the kind of surveillance that you can do by sticking a GPS device on somebody's car. And if the Supreme Court says that this is allowed, all of us are in danger. All of us could have GPS devices attached to our cars, and the police could find out all sorts of things about us. The examples used were, you know, if you go to the gym, when you go to the dry cleaners, if you're an unfaithful husband, all sorts of things that aren't anybody's business.
Maggie, clearly the police in Washington thought they probably should have a warrant. I mean, they went to the trouble to get one. It's just that it had expired.
It had expired, and they also used it outside the jurisdiction they were allowed to use it. But now they're saying, hey, you know what? We don't need the warrant anyway. This isn't anything private. This is the guy's car, and he was out on public streets.
So the Obama administration is coming in here for exactly that perspective, right? I mean, they're looking for pretty aggressive use of the GPS tracking.
They say this would be an incredible tool for law enforcement. It would be so much easier to track terrorists, they say, and to look for big drug dealers. These kinds of devices are really useful before you could even get a warrant. Usually for a warrant, you have to say, look, we think this drug deal's about to go down. We think this guy's about to kill someone. We think this person's about to plant a bomb. You could use the GPS device even earlier to get that initial evidence to even go ahead and do something more intrusive.
But in an era where GPS is just the beginning, where all kinds of things are tracked about our whereabouts and where we are and what's going on there and who else might be there every which way with new apps and what wireless towers and all the rest. I mean, if the court greenlights this, it looks like it could be just the beginning of all kinds of technology brought to bear on what some may have thought of as their personal privacy.
Well, think about what you carry around and what it tells the rest of the world. I mean, just ignore Facebook. If you sign into Facebook and you agree what you're going to share with that, but you carry a cell phone. If it's on, that GPS device is tracking you, and it's pinging to every nearby cell tower and telling anyone who cares to find that information where you are and where you've been. We've already had that issue with iPhones doing it, and people were very upset. Imagine if the police were allowed to say, you've chosen to carry that cell phone, therefore we can use that cell phone to track you.
Maggie Fox, technology editor with the National Journal. Thank you very much for being with us today, Maggie.
My pleasure.
Let's go to the big issues here. Privacy, the U.S. Constitution. Daniel Solov joins us from George Washington University Law School, professor of privacy and technology law there, author of The Digital Person and his latest book, Nothing to Hide, The False Trade-Off Between Privacy and Security. Daniel Solov, welcome to On Point. Welcome back. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what do you think the court's going to be looking most closely at here? Where does the rubber meet the road in this case?
Well, I think one of the challenges in this case for privacy and Fourth Amendment protection against GPS devices is the fact that the Supreme Court has held in a series of cases that there is no privacy in public. And so there is a line of Supreme Court cases where the police are engaging in surveillance of people, and the court said that there's no reasonable expectation of privacy if someone's in public. In order to get Fourth Amendment protection, you have to have a reasonable expectation of privacy.
So if the court sticks with that perspective, are you assuming, though, that they may well come down with the government here, saying, sorry, warrant or no warrant, GPS tracker is slapped on your car, and that's fine?
That's correct. And there was an earlier case decided that involved a beeper, which was a more primitive kind of device that they actually gave to a person who then tricked a person into taking it, and then they tracked his car around as he drove around. And the Supreme Court said, and this was a much less pervasive form of surveillance than the GPS, but it still tracked his movements in public when he was driving. And the court said, well, he's driving in public. The police officer could follow the person and see what the person would have done. This is just a technological enhancement of that, and it's okay. There's no expectation of privacy as someone drives around in public.
Boy, but when you think about all the ways we can be tracked in public now, I mean, I'm looking here at the text of the Fourth Amendment, the U.S. Constitution. It's up at our website, onpointradio.org, if you want to refresh yourselves, listeners. It says, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue, but upon probable cause. Maybe this is a time for the court to pause and reconsider, given all the ways in which technologies are certainly tracking our persons, and now the equivalence of our papers and effects, never mind our houses, but persons, papers, and effects. I mean, people carry an awful lot of their digital equivalent around now with them, don't they?
Absolutely. And I've long lamented the way that the Supreme Court has interpreted the scope of Fourth Amendment protection. I think it's way too narrow. The court has said that the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply to a whole host of things that I think it should apply to. The Fourth Amendment really is the primary way that we have to regulate what the police can and can't do. And the law enforcement officials, the police, the FBI, other law enforcement officials have a tremendous amount of power. And today, with modern technology, can gather oodles of information about people. And that is something that I think should be regulated. It doesn't mean it should be stopped. It doesn't mean that the police shouldn't be allowed to ever use GPS devices or other forms of technology. But what the Fourth Amendment says is that if they're going to use these technologies and gather a lot of information, the way the Fourth Amendment regulates is that it requires the police to go to a court and justify before a judge why they need it. And it provides certain oversight by a neutral party, the court. And it also limits the sort of unfettered discretion of what a law enforcement officer might do. So it provides some limitation. It provides oversight. That's really the question. Do we want the police to engage in GPS surveillance without any kind of judicial oversight, without any kind of limitation? Or do we want there to be some kind of limitation to what the police can do?
And
that's
really
the issue.
If it's an open road on GPS, does that suggest that as technology grows more and more conscious of where you are and what you're doing at every second, that those technologies would may also be available to law enforcement to track you, Professor?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it depends on the logic that the court pushes, but if it pushes very strongly this logic that people don't have expectations of privacy in public, and therefore you can gather any kind of information about their movement in public or what they do in public, as you have this proliferation of technology that can gather the minutiae of what people do throughout their lives, this then will really, I think, eliminate what people do have privacy in public. So people don't expect total secrecy when they're in public, but they expect a kind of obscurity. They expect that when they go to the store, when they go here or there, when they drive to different places, that someone isn't gathering every speck of information about what they're doing.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking today about GPS tracking and unreasonable search. It's before the Supreme Court today. How, when, where the government can track you in the high-tech age. Lawyer Walter Dellinger represents Antoine Jones in this case, the convicted drug kingpin who's now out as when that conviction was overturned on appeal. Nina Totenberg reported on this morning on NPR's Morning Edition. Here's Dellinger talking about saying it's not whether law enforcement can use GPS devices, it's about whether they should get a warrant, he says. And there are dangers, he said, of warrantless GPS tracking.
If the Supreme Court gave a green light to it, any officer can install a GPS device for any reason on anybody's car, even if the officer thinks it'd be interesting to see where Supreme Court justices are going at night when they leave the courthouse. No one would be immune from having GPS devices installed on their vehicles.
Something for the justices to think about there from Antoine Jones' representation, Walter Dellinger. Here also from Nina's piece on Morning Edition. This is Pat Rowan, former federal prosecutor, assistant attorney general in the Bush administration, though the Obama administration is also pushing for this use of GPS. But here's Rowan saying warrantless GPS tracking is an electronic version just of good old-fashioned human surveillance.
You're talking about a very clear line that the Supreme Court has laid down over a very long time, that what the police can observe in public, an individual doesn't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in. And this is the functional equivalent, they would argue, of having the police do a very effective, covert surveillance of an individual over a long period of time.
Hey, we've been doing it for a long time. You've seen it in the movies, slouched in the car, watching you go here and there. What's the difference, that or GPS? Or maybe one day everything else is tracking you these days with all the high-tech equipment that is now out there in our homes and on our persons wherever we go. Daniel Soloff joins us. He's a professor at the George Washington University Law School, author of Nothing to Hide and Understanding Privacy. Right now, joining us as well from Rockville, Maryland, is Cliff Fishman. He's professor at the Columbus School of Law at the Catholic University of America, author of the book Wiretapping and Eavesdropping, former assistant district attorney for New York County. Cliff Fishman, thank you very much for being with us.
Pleasure to be here, Tom.
You may have heard Daniel Soloff saying he expects that the court will indeed go for a narrow ruling here that leaves a lot of this GPS usage open to police. Do you think that's the right way to go?
I don't think it's the right way. I think it may be the right way for the court to go, but I think the problem is that this is an area where it's hard for the Supreme Court to make subtle differences and subtle distinctions and nuanced decisions. This is something that cries out for legislation. Congress has much more authority to pick and choose different ways of regulating to some extent, but not fully. To require a search warrant may make it impossible quite often for the police to use this technique as a preliminary step to gather evidence. Whereas to leave it totally unregulated does expose it to the abuses that your other guests, Maggie and Daniel and Walter, were talking about. The difficulty is every time you impose restrictions or requirements on the police, you make their job harder, and they're less likely to be able to protect us effectively from criminals, from, for example, a drug dealer who was dealing in hundreds of kilos of drugs and hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash. it's a compromise. You restrict it, you regulate it, they become less efficient, you decide not to restrict it, there's a greater likelihood for abuse.
So you've been
I'd like to see the court come down with a narrow decision that strongly invites Congress to legislate. If Congress can ever do anything other than not solve the debt crisis, maybe they can get back to work on other things.
Well, we'll talk about that. But you've been a district attorney. Do you see equivalency here between the kind of following somebody around in a car or on foot that police have done forever and... Well, let's take GPS tracking just for starters, but then we've got to think about all the other ways of tracking that are coming down the line here. Are those the same thing?
Tom, if I were a prosecutor arguing a case, I would argue yes, but as a law professor, I think no. There's a huge difference between following somebody from point A to point B on a particular day and a 24/7, round-the-clock, every 10-second readout from a computer telling me where a particular car is, how long it stopped, how fast it's going. That degree of information is something that should be available to the police only with some degree of regulation, whether it should be a search warrant based on probable cause or a court order based on some lesser evidence. Again, that's something that Congress is in a better position to make the decision about than the Supreme Court, which really can't create a whole regulatory scheme because its role is limited. Is it constitutional or isn't it? I don't know how the court's going to solve this one. I almost hope the court says this is okay without a warrant because that might prompt Congress to actually act and figure out a way of regulating this sort of surveillance in a way that strikes the right balance between police efficiency and privacy protection.
Daniel Solov, if the court says that it's okay without a warrant, go for it, law enforcement. Do you really think Congress will come in and give us some kind of, you know, subtle legislation here that protects our persons and papers and effects in the digital age?
Tom, I hope so. Do I think so? I think very few of us have a whole lot of faith in Congress's ability or willingness to do anything these days. On the other hand, a decision for the police in this case saying it was not a violation of the Constitution might just galvanize enough people to get angry enough at Congress to get Congress to actually do something. And the interesting thing is that the usual split between left and right, Republicans and Democrats, there are an awful lot of people on the right side of the spectrum, the very, very conservative Republicans, who are just as upset about the ability of the police to use all this technology without supervision as people on the left. So there's a distinct possibility that the right wing of the Republicans and the mainstream of the Democrats might get together, and in fact, for that, the mainstream of both parties, might get together and say, yeah, this is something we can compromise about, A, because it's not going to raise taxes or cut entitlements, and B, because we can show people we're doing something anyway. Now, that may be an unrealistic expectation, given Congress's inability to do pretty much anything. But ideally, that would be the solution.
Professor Fishman, what about a kind of a balance of arms here? I mean, I suppose right now, criminals are probably not using GPS tracking to track the police that might want to be looking for them. But there's all kinds of technology coming on stream that hypothetically criminals could also use to stay clear of law enforcement
and the smart ones are using it. The smart ones keep up with what law enforcement is doing. They read the papers, they read the trade journals, and they're aware of the technology that's available to them too. The way they use the cell phones you can purchase and throw away and constantly switching phones so that a tap on a particular cell phone will produce almost no information. The smart criminals know what they're doing. The typical street criminal probably doesn't, but the really sophisticated ones are already probably using counter-surveillance equipment.
So will our law enforcement lose its efficacy if it can't kind of stay in the game, in the sort of arms race of technology, surveillance and awareness?
I agree, and that's why we should resist the instinctive reaction to saying they shouldn't be allowed to do this, or we should make it very, very difficult for the police to do this. We have to take a nuanced approach. We have to make all sorts of new technology available to the police under circumstances where they can use it effectively and efficiently, but under circumstances where there's some control over how they do it and what they do with the resulting information. Striking that right balance is something that's very difficult for a court to do, because it doesn't have the degree of creativity or, for that matter, the knowledge base. I mean, what Congress should do is they should have hearings, they should have people on from the police testify, people from the civil liberties side of the aisle testify, have people do studies of technology, and then there will be an adequate basis of knowledge so Congress can figure out how the compromise should best be structured. What the Supreme Court has is briefs from two sides, plus maybe a few amicus friend of the court briefs, without all of the vast knowledge that Congress can accumulate when it conducts hearings and make a decision.
Daniel Solov, I'm thinking about how does privacy work in this age when And just think about all the things that are tracking,
Tom,
that we're tracking
question.
Ourselves now. But let me put this to you first. Here, the framers could not even imagine. It's like magic. It's like, omniscience. You can know where people are all the time. You can know maybe what product they're looking at, what store they're in, where their buddies are relative to them. It is almost magical in terms that the framers could have imagined, you know, two centuries and more ago, Daniel. So how do we proceed?
Well, absolutely. I think that it really is quite amazing what technology can do and how that is so vastly different in capability than what existed at the time of the framing. I think that's why the framers wrote the Fourth Amendment to be very broad. Interestingly, they wrote the Fourth Amendment and they didn't include the word privacy, even though the court says that the Fourth Amendment only applies when someone has an expectation of privacy. That's not what the framers actually said. What they said was the right to be secure. They actually used the word secure against unreasonable searches and seizures.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very broad phrase. And I think that there was actually a big debate over wiretapping in its earlier days. In a case called Olmstead, it was decided in 1928, and the Supreme Court there thought that the only way you had a violation of the Fourth Amendment is if there was a physical trespass into someone's property.
Right.
And the court concluded there was no reasonable expectation. It didn't say no reasonable expectation. It just said there's no Fourth Amendment protection on wiretapping. And this created an outcry. There was a big dissent by Justice Louis Brandeis, who said, well, we can't just let technology change and then take away all the Fourth Amendment protection that we have. We have to preserve it. We have to interpret the Fourth Amendment in light of changing technology. It took the court 40 years, but about 40 years later, the Supreme Court reversed this decision about wiretapping and said that wiretapping was protected by the Fourth Amendment. Unfortunately, after that, that was when the court adopted its approach of looking at privacy rather than physical trespass. Unfortunately, after that, the court has issued these series of decisions which have basically held that there's no privacy in practically anything. And I think that's really unfortunate.
Yep.
I also agree, I do agree with Professor Fishman about the Congress could play a really good role here. I also agree with him that it's unlikely, and that's why I think it's very important for the court to find that there's Fourth Amendment protection here. The law that regulates electronic surveillance was passed back in 1986,
mm-hmm.
and has barely been amended or addressed, except for some more minor tweaks to that law, in over 25 years.
Look at the explosion of capacity for surveillance in that time. I want to bring our listeners in. Daniel Soloff, Cliff Fishman, please stand by. Let's go first to Wayland, Massachusetts, and Marcus. Marcus, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd like to just make a comment on your reading of the Fourth Amendment. And I think the professors will agree with me that the Fourth Amendment literally has really no application to the conversation because it's been interpreted and applied so many times over the last several hundred years that unless you are familiar with that body of case law, you're likely to be misled or misinformed. And I think it's a very important point. I'd like to get their comments
on
that.
In what sense, Marcus? I mean, shouldn't I, as a citizen, be able to read the words of the United States Constitution? And
no. And I'm sorry that you can't do that. That's
well, I'm going to hold on to that. I'm going to hold on to that right anyway, Marcus. It's
well,
here. It's in my hand.
That. But all that I'm saying to you, Tom,
yeah.
is that unless you're familiar with the body of case law that the professors have been talking about, applying the Fourth Amendment tests,
yeah.
for example, then you're really not discussing it in an updated manner so that you know what that language means.
Okay.
And the way that the courts apply it.
Yeah, I'll take
I'm not
that.
Being critical.
No, well, it is. I take your point. I take your point. These things evolve. The court lays down its markers. I mean, as a citizen, I want to reserve my right to read the plain language that the founders handed down and interpret it. I also am afraid of over time, and I don't want to handcuff law enforcement here, but I also don't want to be undressed at every moment in my own country under this Constitution. But Daniel Soloff, what about it? Here I am. I'm reading the Fourth Amendment. Can I not understand the words in front of me because I'm not trained in law school and interpretation over two centuries?
Well, unfortunately, I mean, the court has interpreted a lot of the Constitution in ways that are very, very different or depart from what the original text is. And it's sometimes unfortunate, sometimes good, because we're dealing with a document that was written quite a long time ago. And times change, technologies change, and new circumstances arise. And the document was written very broadly and in a rather vague manner to try to deal with the new things that are going to develop.
But I wonder who has to catch up here, you know, me as the untutored, you know, student of law, or the justices, when the technology changes so much that you kind of have to look back at the original understanding of some kind of privacy in the world and say, wait a minute, do we seem within range of that?
Well, it's a tough challenge for the justices to try to figure out. Well, what would, you know, someone have thought about this, you know, 200 years ago when we didn't have anything coming even close to the technologies we have today? But I do think that there are some things that we can look to in the history, some broad things about what the framers didn't like to help inform our decision. For example, one of the things that they detested and one of the things that inspired the Fourth Amendment was what was known as dragnet searches, when the British would be able to enter someone's people's homes without any kind of suspicion at all and just hunt around for incriminating evidence. And this is something that they really were fighting against when they passed the Fourth Amendment. And that is actually, I think, what GPS surveillance can do. It can, without Fourth Amendment protection, it can allow the police to follow a person's movements, a person who may be completely innocent, and just find out, do they do anything that looks suspicious?
I mean, there's King George sitting in London with his iPad tracking Paul Revere down the way. Richie in Nashville, Tennessee. Richie, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. This scares me in that what could happen afterwards were this to be passed, in that it was briefly touched on earlier, that even the speed that you're going, if a cop could get the information that you were going over the speed limit, then that warrants them being able to search your car even and say, you know, we find anything. That leaves such a broad spectrum of laws that just aren't even touched upon, because technology is advancing so fast.
But Richie, what about somebody who then says, okay, Richie, don't speed. It's against the law to speed. And by the way, also don't have cocaine in your car. Just don't break the law and don't worry about
it. It's not that, but it's just Big Brother, that if the police officers are there and they're watching you do something, that's one thing. But sitting remotely watching what you're doing, I believe that's a whole different thing, and that, you know,
yeah, Richie, I appreciate your call. Yeah, Cliff Fishman, do you think we're on a path toward, you'd like Congress to get in here, but the path we're on at the moment, are we on a reasonable balance of technology and privacy looking at this century where so much is going to be exposed, or do you see danger?
Well, I see a lot of danger, Tom, for all of the reasons that Professor Solo and your last caller both emphasized. Technology, the ability to surveil, the ability to gather information, and by the way, I'm much more afraid about the amount of information that corporations can gather against us than I am the government, because the government's resources are much more limited.
Yep.
Whereas every corporation, do you use a courtesy card or a bonus card at a supermarket? Because if you do, your supermarket has a very, very detailed outline of your life.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about GPS tracking and unreasonable searches. Before the Supreme Court today, how, when, where the government can track you in the high-tech age, at least when it comes to GPS tracking. In the case of Antoine Jones, they slapped a GPS tracker on his Jeep Cherokee and kept track of him. Turns out, after a warrant had expired. Now, if the warrant had not expired, it doesn't look like there'd be much grounds here, but it had. And an appeals court overturned a life sentence for him on charges of cocaine and all the rest. Now it's before the Supreme Court, and the odds appear to be, from our legal scholars here today, that the court will support the police in this instance. But the technology just keeps on growing, and the surveillance opportunities just keep on growing with it. Daniel Solove is with us from George Washington University Law School, author of Nothing to Hide. Cliff Fishman is here from the Columbus School of Law at the Catholic University of America, author of Wiretapping and Eavesdropping. We've got all kinds of comments here, people lined up on the phones and online. Some saying, look, you know, don't break the law and you've got no problem. And here's Dave on Twitter says, in public there's great privacy in the anonymity of the crowd. This must be protected. Joe American says, government interference in civilian lives must be severely restricted, lest we end up with a totalitarian dictatorship. No spying, please, he says there. We're joined right now as well by Maggie Reardon. She's a senior writer for CNET, joins us from New York. Maggie, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you're no legal scholar, but you know about the technology that's exploding under us right now. I mean, when you look at all the ways in which our whereabouts and what we're up to do can be tracked today, GPS tracking looks kind of primitive or just like, you know, the OG of this world. What else is out there and coming, Maggie, that will put our lives, sort of make them transparent technologically?
Well, I mean, GPS is really sort of the key. It's the foundation. And GPS right now is usually accurate in about 20 feet of your location, but the government is spending about $8 billion to update the satellites that are orbiting around the Earth, and they're going to be able to track you to within a couple feet. And then we've also got some assisted GPS on the ground, cell phone towers that help triangulate, and that makes the GPS reading a lot quicker and also helps with accuracy. So, I see this technology only getting more and more refined and being able to pinpoint where you are maybe exactly in a room.
But it's not just your physical location anymore, because the commercial applications are weaving so much awareness around that of what you're doing there, what you're shopping for, what you may be buying, who else in your social circle may be near you, right? All this is happening. The whole matrix of at least commercial outlets that are also in your immediate vicinity.
Yes, that's true. You've got Google doing a lot of things with its new Google Wallet that it has just introduced on some new Google Android phones, and they have this Google Offers. So exactly what you're saying, you know, when you're out purchasing something using your phone, it's using your location. Now, they say that you can turn these elements on and off, and what I find interesting is that people readily give up a lot of this information.
Yeah.
Because they want to get the special offers that some of the companies are giving them. So, you know, I think that's something people really need to consider, too. How much information do you want to give out there about your location? And to be aware that when you say yes to receiving coupons or signing up for Foursquare to get, you know, to be the mayor of your local coffee shop so that you can get $5 off every month or something, that, you know, you're giving up a little bit of that information about where you are and what you do and what you're buying.
And just for people who may not use it, Foursquare, where you're putting out there, here's where I am, and you can also see where your buddies are at that moment.
Yeah, and it's a very popular service, and a lot of services are offering this. You know, there are even dating websites now that people can sort of put out there, you know, I'm here and I'm available, and if you're, you know, in a 4-block radius, you know,
let's have a date
I'm
right now.
For a date. Yeah, exactly.
Maggie, stand by. Cliff Fishman, help us with this, because this is kind of the equivalent, much more sophisticated, but it seems to me in a way like old telephone service. But the government, on the telephone front anyway, after 9/11 came in and started doing all kinds of wiretapping with the cooperation of commercial service providers. So is there a scenario here, or maybe it's happening right now, Professor Fishman, where all of this commercial capacity that people are voluntarily signing up for, but probably not thinking that it's all going to be, you know, looked over by, let's say, law enforcement or the National Security Agency, the NSA or some, is it possible the government can just wade right in there and start using all of this surveillance as well?
It's possible. It's not likely that the companies like Google would voluntarily turn the information over, because then they could get sued by their subscribers.
Yeah, but look what happened with the phone companies. I mean, they put the arm on them, and didn't they protect them from suits also?
That was only in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, when we were all somewhat paranoid, and perhaps properly and correctly so. And that got eventually that came to light, and I doubt if that's going to happen again because of the backlash from it. For law enforcement to be able to access all of the information that Google or for that matter, the supermarket or drugstore courtesy cards collect about us, however, would only require a subpoena at this point. which is easy enough for a prosecutor to get. He goes to a grand jury and says, I'm opening an investigation. Please give me a subpoena. And 24 hours later, the subpoena is served on the corporation.
But is that a probable cause situation? Does he at least have to make the case that there's probable cause in that case?
What situation?
To get the subpoena, does he have to make the case there's probable cause of crime?
No. A subpoena, basically, if I'm a prosecutor in a grand jury, I tell the grand jury, let's investigate thus and so, and that authorizes me as a prosecutor to issue subpoenas in the grand jury's name. And the purpose of a grand jury basically is to investigate. It's to gather evidence to find out whether a crime has been committed or not, whether or not there's a societal problem with, for example, how bids are handed out for construction or whatever the grand jury, that is the prosecutor, wants to investigate. But the point is the power of a prosecutor to subpoena records and documents and information from you, from me, from your employer, from my employer, from Google, from AOL, is almost unlimited. And that's also a problem that we have to worry about.
Daniel Sullivan, are you confident that it won't bleed over into this area of all the information that's commercially collected out there? I mean, yes, you can get a subpoena, but one of the things we want to be on top of criminality. We want to be stopping it. Constitutionally, but people have also traditionally in this country wanted some zone of privacy or around their politics. Let's say the government just doesn't like the cut of my politics. Can they start tracking me on Foursquare and you name it and to see who I'm associating with?
Well, yes, they can. And I generally agree with Professor Fishman. You know, he was talking about the subpoena process, which actually is an immensely easy way for the government to gather information. I think way too easy for the government to gather information about from Google and various other entities that have your information. And I think that the problem again comes back to the lack of Fourth Amendment protection. I mean, the court in a series of cases held that when a third party possesses your records, you don't have an expectation of privacy, which then allows the government to obtain those records without a warrant and probable cause.
Boy, third parties know just about everything now.
Exactly. And that's a huge problem, again, with the court's very faulty logic in understanding privacy and the way it interprets the Fourth Amendment. When it comes to political persuasions and political beliefs, a lot of that is actually public because your donations are publicly reported. So if you want to find out someone's politics, you can just do a search online and find out who they donated to. So that's just everyone can do that, in fact.
That's one kind of politics. But there were the stories recently about people in the environmental movement being followed. Anyway, let's get our listeners. Mark, Columbia, South Carolina. Mark, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
How you doing, Tom?
Okay, what do you think?
I think it was a great thing that they did by tapping this guy's car or whatever they did to locate these drugs. Because what they need to do is stop making excuses for the ones that are committing these crimes. If you got all these drugs out on the streets to our kids, so you got to look at when the law supersedes life and what could have happened when all these drugs would have been put out there for our children.
Yeah.
We have to watch out for the bigger issue. It's not about getting this guy out or anybody, for instance, that are caught breaking the law to this extent and looking for a way out. And now he's probably laughing at the justice system. When is justice not justice is when it's going to jeopardize the lives of the ones that are really trying to do what's right.
I hear you, Mark. Antoine Jones walking from a life sentence, 200 pounds of cocaine, if it was your kids that he was selling to or mine, of course, you'd be upset about that. At the same time, we do watch our freedoms. We do watch our constitutional guarantees. But I hear exactly what you're saying. Let me get one more. Megan Whitman, Massachusetts. Megan, you're on the air.
Hi. I just was wanted to say the naive, if you have nothing to hide, if you live within the law, I think you're probably safe. But also, it's got me thinking just technology-wise about a story from Oregon a couple of years ago where a family got lost in the snow, and they tried tracking them. Someone tried tracking them by their cell phones, but they couldn't give the information out.
The company wouldn't tell them where they were, so what happened?
Well, the husband ended up dying, and the rest of the family was saved, but someone had the information. They just couldn't pass it on because it was illegal. So I think
that was
just a blanket kind of a thing of trying to figure out when it's okay to share the information and when.
Yeah, yeah. Megan, let us pick that up as well. Maggie Reardon, I hear you there.
Yeah, I was going to say actually that unfortunately that story was one of our CNET editors, which is so that story really hit very close
to home. Froze to death when they couldn't give up his location via the cell phone.
Exactly, and it wasn't a matter of it being illegal to give up his information. Mm-hmm. That was a matter of it technologically not being possible. He was in an area where there wasn't much cell phone reception, and he didn't have a phone that had GPS on it, per se.
I see.
He had phones, you know, the phones that he and his wife had were just sort of regular phones that, you know, and in emergencies, you know, there is this ability to be able to try to track people, and they use cell phone triangulation.
Yep.
Or cell tower triangulation. So, but the problem is that if you're in an area where you're not getting any coverage and you're not getting signal, then unfortunately they can't track you. So in some ways, GPS finders and receivers are actually better in that instance. If they had had something that was a GPS receiver, then his location probably would have been able to have been found.
Cliff Fishman, here's our caller Mark saying, look, I don't want 200 pounds of extra cocaine on the street. This guy's laughing at the justice system now. Use the technology, get him off. And here's our caller, you know, just now saying, kind of suggesting, just obey the law and then have the advantage of all this transparency. You can get tracked in a snowstorm and saved from freezing to death. I mean, these things suggest
there are advantages to being able to be tracked. But I understand what Mark is saying. I sympathize to an extent. But remember, Mark has to remember the police can do this to him and to me as well. And while I'm not committing any crimes and Mark's not committing any crimes, do I want the police to be able to gather everything that they can learn about me simply because they're curious, even though they have no hard evidence to go on? The fact that I go to a particular movie, the fact that I go to shop in a particular place, the fact that, you know, I keep kosher, maybe they can track me to a pork restaurant and discover the fact that I'm breaking my religious rules when I think nobody's looking. I don't want people to be able to find that out about me. Simply because they're curious and I have a toy they want to play with. So I agree with Mark that when somebody like Jones walks away, the entire law is held up to disrespect. And I think Professor Sola would agree also that the unfortunate result of a case in which evidence is suppressed is that the law is not enforced, people go free who shouldn't, and other people are victimized. But we still have to strike the balance between letting the police do their job effectively and protecting everybody's privacy. I don't care about the privacy of Jones. I care about the privacy of you and Professor mm-hmm. Sola and myself and mm-hmm. Maggie Fox and everybody else out there who is a potential target of surveillance of this kind with no justification but with no supervision.
Daniel Sullivan, if you could be before the Supreme Court today, as they've heard this case portrayed, if you could just kind of open the conversation up to talk with them about privacy and where this country's headed in such high technology era, what would you be asking them to be mindful of as they consider this case?
I would ask them to be mindful of the direction that their case law is going, and that the Fourth Amendment is not saying that the police can never engage in various surveillance and never use GPS. It is the primary way that we have for judicial oversight over what the police can do. And as technology is changing and evolving and allowing the government to gather unprecedented amounts of personal information, we need a Fourth Amendment protection that's going to put them under adequate oversight over what they're getting. And if we don't have that protection, we can hold out the hope that maybe someday when Congress gets its act together in 2092, that they'll pass a law, or we can protect it now with the Fourth Amendment. And I think that if the Fourth Amendment is going to remain a relevant protection and a relevant way to make sure that the government doesn't abuse its power, then we need to interpret it in a way that allows it to protect us as technology changes.
Maggie, as a layperson here, not a lawyer, but you know technology well, I mean, what are you thinking as you listen to this debate? Is it inevitable that the kind of privacy knew when obscurity came with just walking out your door and you couldn't and wouldn't be tracked at every moment without an awful lot of effort? You know, does privacy just kind of bleed away from American life, whether we like it or not?
Well, I think what's what's unfortunate in a way is that that so many consumers are giving this information about themselves up so that it makes it easier. You know, the technology for sure is going to be easier. It's going to get easier and easier and cheaper and cheaper. So we're going to have GPS in all kinds of products. I mean, you have them now. You can put chips on your shoes so that you can track your runs and your workouts.
Yeah.
You know, that technology is also getting into other kinds of devices that you carry for working out and so forth. So, but I think what's, you know, people have to be mindful of is, you know, when you want those services and you want to use them, just think about, you know, now you're giving somebody else access to information about where you are, and now that information is going to be stored somewhere, and you did it with your consent.
Let's hear it once more, direct from the document, Fourth Amendment, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause. How that gets interpreted in the Supreme Court today and in this country in this century is going to be something to see. Maggie Reardon, senior writer with CNET, thank you so much for being with us from New York, Maggie.
Thanks for having me.
Professor Cliff Fishman at the Columbus School of Law at the Catholic University of America. Professor Fishman, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Daniel Solo at George Washington University Law School. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for being with us today. This is On Point.